I think at times I was absolutely terrified of a lot of the things I did, and I covered it up by a big extrovert front. And I was probably more scared at times than people ever knew or recognized.
You're listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more. Here's your host, as always, Simon Scriver.
So a few months ago, I was very honored to be hosting the fundraising awards at IOF Scotland. And one of the things when you're able to tell crappy jokes and present awards is people mistake you for being important. And what happens is people then put you on a table with other important people. And what happened was I actually managed to sit next to my guest today. And this is the first time I got a chance to meet her. She is Amanda Bringens. Hello, Amanda.
Hello, how are you, Simon?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. It's Friday.
It's Friday, yeah. And
yes. we're nearly
broken up for Christmas, so everyone's happy.
Absolutely. Well, apart from Theresa May, God love her.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'm sorry you're going through all that. I hope you survive.
Yeah, you're going to be in a worse situation when the border goes all horribly wrong.
Oh my God. Okay. This is not a political podcast.
It's not. Let's talk about fundraising.
Yeah, let's talk about fundraising, because you are the number three most influential fundraiser, according to Fundraising Magazine. Did you know that?
I did know that. Not quite sure what to say, but you know, if somebody voted for me to get me to that place, then I'm happy and very delighted about that.
You are very influential. You are the director of fundraising at British Heart Foundation.
Yeah.
And you are the current chair of the Institute of Fundraising.
Yeah.
You also serve as a trustee, and you're everything.
What do you mean, Simon?
Yeah.
I am lucky enough to be doing two or three amazing things as part of my professional career. Yes.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm director of fundraising at the British Heart Foundation, you know, which is a well-established, fantastic charity with a great brand and a wonderful heritage. You know, not without its challenges, like every charity at the moment. I'm sure we can talk about that. The Institute of Fundraising is, as everyone will know, or I hope some of your listeners will know, a fantastic membership organisation that represents fundraisers all across the UK. And that's, of course, how we came to meet when we were both together at the Scottish IOF conference, which was pretty good, actually, I thought. Really good.
Yeah.
And finally, I'm a trustee at Regent's University, which is an independent university, and also a charity. And they are in the middle of setting up their first fundraising function. They've never really had one before, so I'm kind of helping with that. So yes, I'm lucky to be able to contribute to fundraising across the UK, because I love fundraising and I love fundraisers.
You keep talking about being lucky, but I'm always of the thought that the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I can see from your from your past work and everywhere you are, you obviously work very hard. You obviously are very good at what you do. And I would love to pick your brain about fundraising and understand you a bit more.
Yeah.
How did you become a fundraiser? Did you fall into it like everyone else?
Yeah, of course. I became a fundraiser very many years ago. You know, I'm unfeasibly old now. And as we come into Christmas, at the end of a very long year, I must admit, I'm beginning to feel even older. But I think more people are choosing fundraising as a career now. But certainly when I became a fundraiser, that was not the case. So I was working in advertising, selling advertising on the telephone, actually.
Oh, God.
I think when I was at the conference where I met you, I spoke about this on the platform, but I used to sell advertising on the telephone, and I sold it in North London, Camden Town, working for Thompson Regional Newspapers. And that was my very first job in a great big massive building that many people will know, just outside Mornington Crescent Tube Station, which is the Black Cat building. It's a beautiful old Art Deco building where Thompson Regional Newspapers used to be based. So that was my first job. wearing a literally ancient, old, what's that stuff? Bakelite telephone.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thing with a bloody great big horn that came around the side for the microphone. It was just, it was a terrible job. I absolutely hated it.
Cold calling?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, which, of course, you can't do now. We used to cut leads out of the newspapers to follow up. And then you could hound whoever you wanted.
Yeah. Is that not legitimate interest now?
I don't think we'd get away with that, would we? Yeah. And I went through my career in advertising for about 9 years, selling newspaper advertising and then television advertising. And honestly, Simon, I just got sick of it. You know, it was fun. It was the 80s. There was a lot of money around. I had a big expense account. I had a car. It was, you know, it was great. You know, we had very long lunches and, you know, got up to all sorts of shenanigans in the afternoon after long lunches. But it's not very rewarding, or at least it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And I made a decision to change careers, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Went back to university, did a degree in English literature at Goldsmiths, which is a really cool university. Absolutely loved that. Came out, happened to see a job advertised at Comic Relief and went and did Red Nose Day in 95. Wow. And then, you know, like however many years later, I go to work at the BHF. I walk out of the tube at Mornington Crescent Tube Station. I look across the road and I realize that the British Heart Foundation is in the same building as my first job at Thompson Regional Newspapers.
Wow.
So I am now walking out of the tube every day to go into the Black Cat building, which, as I said, is beautiful, which is what I used to do every day when I was 22. So it's funny how what goes around comes around. But fundraising is a great career to be in.
But I'd say you sleep better at night now that you're selling something better than advertising.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But then, you know what us girls are like, and maybe some of you guys as well, we worry about stuff, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, of course, when fundraising is going well, it's great and I love it. But at the moment, things are tough. So don't always sleep well at night.
Yeah, well, it is a tough job. And I mean, when it's going well, it's the best job in the world. And when it's going badly, it's one of the worst jobs in the world.
No, so, it's not the worst job. It'll never be that, Simon. Okay. But it's hard. And I'm sure, how many people listen to your podcast?
Oh, millions.
Oh, millions.
Yeah, yeah. It's growing.
Sure millions of fundraisers out there will know what we mean when we say it can be tough, even though it's fabulous.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. So Comic Relief back in those days, that's like the mid-90s.
Yes, 95.
I don't want to make you feel old, but I remember being in school. I mean, I feel old, but I remember being in school for Comic Relief 95. I remember.
Do you?
That. Yeah.
Wow.
I have a really gross story about what people were doing with their red noses and stuff. Ew. Like that. But I won't.
I can imagine, actually. So perhaps we better not go there.
But it still generated money for you, so you should be delighted.
Great.
And what was Comic Relief back in those days? I mean, it's like it was still huge. It was still a monster, wasn't it?
Because it started, when did it start? 88, I think, was the first one, wasn't it?
Yeah, around then.
86.
Maybe even earlier, yeah.
So it was still, you know, relatively young, and the fundraising office was in an old building around the back road, which no longer exists. It's been knocked down. Mm-hmm. And we were the only residents, I think, in that building before it was about to be demolished. So the fundraising office was kind of out on a limb slightly. Mm. Amanda Horton Mastin was my boss. So many people will know her because she was, until I think quite recently, still at Comic Relief doing a great job. It was the office was makeshift, and everybody was passionate and committed and mostly working on short contracts. So there was no permanent fundraising team at that time. People were just recruited for 6 months prior to the Red Nose Day to kind of build up the fundraising efforts and do more cold calling to people to get them on board. And we used to get visits from Richard Curtis and Lenny Henry and the other celebs who were involved. And so that made the fundraising team feel special and and even more dedicated. And even though it was kind of a bit makeshift, because you were at the cutting edge of doing the work, you know, hitting the phones, going to visit people in a very intense period in the run up to Red Nose Day, it was just a wonderful, fun, hard work, intense atmosphere. Yeah. And then at the end of it, you know, there's a fabulous wrap party. And I can remember Chris Evans being there and Jonathan Ross and Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer. And, you know, and it was back in the day when those guys used to enjoy a beer or two. and it was fabulous, absolutely fabulous. And sitting in the audience, I can remember the night of Red Nose Day 95, sitting in the audience with my fellow fundraisers, four or five of us. And we just sat there in tears going, you know, we did this. We helped to raise all this money.
Yeah, amazing.
And I'm sure the guys who work on it now feel exactly the same, but it is much bigger and much more of a machine.
Yeah.
But then it was just so immediate and so real.
Yeah. It's rare in fundraising. Not rare, but like there's very few people who have that opportunity where you fundraise for something and you see something so big and tangible.
Completely.
To almost celebrate it, to like bookend the end of your all your work. You know, we get a bit of feedback and a bit of stuff we see in terms of the impact we have, but that's huge. You know, celebrities.
It was fabulous, huge and fabulous.
That's really cool. So that switch from advertising to fundraising, is it the same? The skills you're using.
Is it the same? I mean, no, of course it's not the same, but. You know, I remember I was back in advertising. I was in advertising a long time ago, and advertising isn't like that anymore. You know, yes, of course, people have the odd long lunch, but I mean, you know, back in the 80s, it was work hard and play very, very hard. I don't think that kind of culture exists in quite the same way. So it was a big, it was a welcome and pleasant change to come into an environment where people were doing something that they genuinely care about in a different way and are committed because of the cause. Was it different? I mean, when I first came into fundraising, there weren't too many professional fundraisers around. You know, there were databases didn't work or were non-existent. Everything was paper-based. Offices were a mess.
Yeah.
Heads of fundraising in the larger charities tended to be retired army guys. You know, I can't count the number of times I've worked for Lieutenant Colonel this or Major that in my early days, because that's where fundraisers came from. You know, they came up through grassroots communities and then they went to work at a local charity or, you know, whatever. So and so it is now so much more professional, so much. I don't want to say better. It's not better. It's differently run now. Fundraising is differently run now and is much more professional and is much more of a proper, in inverted commas, career. And I welcome that, you know, and that's what the Institute is trying to do as well, you know, professionalize fundraising.
Yeah, and they do it very well.
Get all the guys, you know, you meet so many fundraisers in your job, same as I do, and get them proper recognition for the efforts that they make.
Yeah, well, I think that's a big change, is it's actually recognized as something you can do. And like you said, I mean, IOF have done more work in terms of helping people choose it as a career as opposed to falling into it, which I think is a good thing. But communication has crossed over into all your roles, and you're obviously a good communicator. So like, you know, you talk about picking up the phone for advertising, you talk about picking up the phone for Comic Relief. Do you find like that's dying out a little bit, the ability to actually talk on the phone, to actually speak to people? You know, it's moving to digital a lot, but is that necessarily good for fundraising?
Nobody's ever asked me that before. That's a good point. So I don't think it's as simplistic as that, as saying whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So, I mean, we all have phones on our desks at work. They're very rarely used. So people are talking to agencies, donors, supporters, much less on the phone, I think.
Yeah.
And in terms of our community fundraising colleagues, they're doing a lot of face-to-face work. But digital communication now is the norm, isn't it? So are we losing the ability to communicate? No, because I think we're learning how to communicate in different ways. You know, doing fabulous digital communication. You know, we're doing a podcast that would have been unheard of a few years ago. Doing fabulous personalized stewardship journeys on a digital, in a digital space is important. So it may have changed. You may not have to pick up the phone and sell your wares over the phone, but communication is just as important. But it's, yeah, but it's different.
Yeah, it adapts to the technology and whatever else comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in your career, you moved on from there and you've got big names under your belt. I mean, you've worked for Macmillan, Battersea, VSO, kind of all these household names.
Mm.
But more, I suppose you've obviously moved up and up and up. So now you're a director, you're managing fundraisers. Is that as opposed to fundraising? I mean, do you do much hands-on fundraising these days, or is it very much strategy and guiding people through it?
It's much more leadership and strategy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Much more. So I was very lucky in that after Red Nose Day, my job, I went straight to Macmillan. So I was at Macmillan for a long time, 17 years. And I was very lucky to have a boss who advocated for me very strongly and was a wonderful woman, Judy Beard. And she's retired now, but she was director of fundraising at the British Red Cross. And then she went to Macmillan. And we just hit it off, and she was the one, she was like my mentor, and promoted me a couple of times, and eventually I became director of fundraising after she left Macmillan. So having somebody who is on your side, as it were, really helped me to progress through my career. And I think getting those opportunities, I mean, you know, I know you, I want to say lucky again, but you do have to put yourself in the way of those opportunities, don't you?
Yeah.
So I always advise people whenever I speak, you know, put your hand up, put your hand up for a project or a job or a piece of work that you feel passionate about. You know, get yourself in front of the boss and say, I want to do this. And I did that, and that really helped me to move through. And yes, I have been lucky to work for big brands. But I wanted to work for big brands. You know, I went to, for my sins, I went to boarding school. You know, I'm used to big institutions and big organizations and how they work.
Yeah.
And I know how to maneuver my way around them and how to influence and negotiate. So I like big organizations. And of course, in a big organization, when you're leading a big fundraising team, which I'm lucky enough to do, inevitably, your role is going to become more about strategy and leadership and management and talking to trustees. And I like that.
Yeah.
I really enjoy leadership. I like fundraisers, you know, and I'm delighted and proud to lead a team of fundraisers.
And you like managing people? Because I've fallen in and out of love of managing people.
I've never fallen out of love with managing people, Simon.
You're a very positive spin person, aren't you? I want to get you to criticize something in fundraising.
Oh God, of course I can do that as well. But I genuinely love leading people. Seriously,
are you a good manager? Are you a good leader?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I think I'm probably a little inconsistent at times. I get impatient. I try to do performance management fairly if I need to. I try to describe and lead people towards a clear vision. Mm-hmm. I try to support people in their careers to get development. I don't suffer fools. I'm too picky about grammar and punctuation.
Oh,
yeah, I think my team will tell you that.
That comes from boarding school, I think.
I know. I think that just comes from being. I don't know what it is. No, I know that, I'm joking. I think my team always say there's something she does which really piss us off. But hopefully, overall, I'm okay.
And so in terms of managing your teams and people, I get the impression from the little that I know you that it's important to you to support people and bring them up and help them develop, because people have done that for you in your career.
Correct.
You know, you just talked about that. So how do you do that? Like, how do you support people? Why do people get held back? And what's the difference between someone going forward and maybe not going forward?
That's a good question. Okay, so I think people, let me start that sentence again for you, Simon. When people recognize and have a level of self-awareness about what their strengths and areas for development are, it is far easier for them to move on and develop. And the successes that I have had with leading people and supporting them to be promoted and move through their careers have come about because they've recognized what they need to do better and what they do well. I have spotted those things. We have talked about them together, and I have said, right, I think there's an opportunity here that you should grasp, you should take. And you know how, if you have the right instincts about people and you can spot where there's a huge talent, then I think it is incumbent upon you as a leader to support and direct that talent.
It's
vital. And the people who don't progress are sometimes because they don't want to, and that's okay. You know, if you're a specialist in a particular area and you want to stay in that area of your career, then cool, do it.
Yeah.
But if you're going to get stuck and for some reason you can't work on your problems and develop and grow, then that's a harder nut to crack, isn't it?
On an episode of a while ago, I was talking to Joe Jenkins. Do you know Joe Jenkins?
Yeah.
He's a friend of the podcast.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
But he wrote an article about there being a talent crisis in the sector, and I was talking to him and Nikki Bell, who is past British Art Foundation.
Yeah, love Nikki. Hi, Nikki.
He's another friend of the podcast, and we were talking about, you know, is there a talent crisis and what's coming up? One of Nikki's points was, you know, she was talking about diversity, which I know is really important to you. I've heard you speak about diversity in the sector.
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about it from kind of a regional area and a working class area, and I've heard you speak about it from you know, people of color, and from women, and how we bring those other voices in. This is something that's important to you in your management, isn't it? I gather.
Yes. I wouldn't say that we have a talent crisis. I think there is a plethora of talent out there. And I see, you know, being in a big charity for whom lots of people hopefully want to work, I'm in a position where I'm seeing many more fundraisers come through. Mm-hmm. And I do appreciate that when you work in a smaller charity or a tiny charity and you're in the middle of a rural area or far from a town or a city, then it is, of course, going to be more difficult to recruit talent, in inverted commas. That's not that it doesn't exist. It's more about whether we have the resources, the skills, and the ability to be able to access it. So all the work that the Institute does on pushing out the qualifications, the move towards chartered status for fundraisers, the diversity work that the Institute is doing, all of that is geared towards increasing the talent pool. I think it's more about our ability to access the talent and grow and develop it rather than an absence of it.
Yeah, like the talent crisis, if not for want of a better word, it's on our side in terms of opening the door as opposed to the people who are trying to get in that door.
Yeah.
And we need to be better at that. And I think, I mean, what are the Institute of Fundraising's priorities in terms of with you as the chair, what are you trying to change right now?
So the equality, diversity, and inclusion work that the Institute is doing is vital for us to do exactly that, to increase the talent pool and to make the profession more diverse. Because if we, you know, the business case for diversity is clear. If you have a more diverse workforce, you are inevitably, ultimately more successful. You get better ideas, you get a better breadth and depth of opinions and ways of working. So I think there's a strong business case for diversity, which the corporate sector has done a lot of work on and made really clear. There's a moral case for it as well.
Yeah. You know,
we have to reflect the populations we serve, our beneficiaries, better than we do. And therefore, that work, the EDI work that we're doing, I think is crucial for the future of fundraising as a rich and vibrant profession.
Yeah.
And there are, you may have seen that the Change Collective, which is the name for the work that we're doing, launched a couple of weeks ago now, and there's a manifesto for change, which clearly lays out the priorities and the pieces of work that we're going to do, you know, around women in leadership, about supporting organizations to think better and more proactively about increasing diversity in their fundraising workforce. So I'm really proud of that work. And then linked to that is the journey towards chartered status. Now, that's an interesting conversation. There's mixed opinions about that. You know, is becoming a chartered fundraiser an old-fashioned construct, or is it something that actually for some fundraisers, perhaps who are lone or sole fundraisers in smaller organizations, will bring them more status and more kudos and recognition in a way that would actually be welcomed by their boards of trustees and their beneficiaries, et cetera. So that's a very much a live debate.
The people who are saying it's old, you know, old fashioned, what's their alternative?
So let's just rehearse the argument about it being old fashioned. I mean, I think that argument comes essentially and possibly from the people who work for larger charities in a metropolitan setting, who perhaps wouldn't feel the need to have their fundraisers called chartered fundraisers, the Chartered Institute of Fundraising. So if you're in an environment where fundraising is recognised and supported and invested in, why would you need it? You know.
Yeah.
What's it going to bring?
Yeah.
And what's the alternative to that? I'm not sure that anybody's put forward a viable alternative to it. You know, should we have a movement, for example, to push fundraising into the spotlight, you know, something like Me Too? Let's make fundraising a fabulous, sexy profession for people to come into by utilizing other means. I think that the argument for chartered status has been made very clearly, and it was agreed by the IOF trustees 2014, I think, so about 4 years ago, and was put on the back burner when we went through 2015, the summer of 2015, when things became difficult for fundraising, as we all remember, and it's very much been brought back to the table now since I've been working with Peter as chair, and I'm 100% for it, because I think for certain sectors of the fundraising profession, it will bring huge benefits.
Yeah, no, it seems like a great thing for me. I've worked in small organizations before, and most of my clients are small, and it's usually a fundraiser who is not respected as a profession, you know, or is kind of ostracized from the rest of the organization. And I like the sound of it. I think it sounds positive.
And fundraising is still seen, isn't it, by many organizations as, you know, a bit kind of... It's a necessary evil.
Yeah.
You know, all that asking for money, you know, it's all we do. Yeah.
It's a little bit embarrassing, isn't it?
We don't like that. We're terribly British about it.
Yeah.
And we have to get over that. You know, that whole point about aligning mission, you know, delivering your mission and vision with income generation, we have to get over our fear of doing that.
Yeah. It's part of what we do. Yeah. Do you remember the IOF? Was that in your time as the chair, the IOF campaign, Proud Fundraiser?
No, it was before my time. Great fundraiser. You know, everybody remembers that campaign. That was fabulous, really effective.
Yeah, there's something really strong. I mean, really effective for those who are already proud. I don't know if it changed anyone's minds on the outside, but I loved it. It did make me feel proud. And I remember going to the IOF convention and people wearing those and saying that. And it was great. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I don't want to keep you too long because you're a busy woman.
It's okay.
What's your priorities? What's next for you?
Personally?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, I'm right in the middle of implementing the fundraising strategy at the British Heart Foundation.
Yeah.
We have a lot to do. So we have a brand that is well-loved and respected. But the perception of the British Heart Foundation amongst the public is that, you know, we're probably that there isn't an urgent need for money. You know, think about the name foundation. That's quite an interesting construct, isn't it? Sometimes people think that we are wealthier than we actually are. But heart disease is not seen as such an urgent cause as, say, cancer. And the new brand that we put out earlier this year and the new fundraising strategy, which I'm implementing now, is taking up all of my time. So at the moment, I'm completely focused on getting the fundraising team, who are amazing, by the way. Hello, all of you. Getting them absolutely resourced up to be able to deliver the income generation aspirations that we have. So that's my first priority. Personally, I have to think about, you know, because as I said to you at the beginning, I am unfeasibly old. I have to think about what I want to do next. And I've still got loads to do at the British Heart Foundation, but in the back of my mind, it's, you know, what do I do? Where do I go? And I don't want to be a consultant. One day, do I want to be a chief executive? Perhaps I do. And there aren't enough women. I don't know, Simon. Sometimes I think, do you know what? Sometimes I think I do, and sometimes, oh my God, that scares the pants off me.
Oh, you'd be great.
Well, I'd do my best, put it like that. So while I am focused absolutely on the British Heart Foundation, I'm thinking about, you know, in 5, 6, 7 years, what do I do?
Where? Oh God, it's hard to know. I mean, do you like, do you look back on your career and do you think like how do you stop burning out? Because you've just kind of kept moving and kept moving and moving up and done more and more. Are you, like, I worry about you, Amanda.
Don't talk nonsense, Simon. Yeah, listeners, he says he worries. I doubt it.
Simon. I do. Are you gonna,
thank you for that.
Are you going to keep pushing?
For the moment, yes, absolutely. I think it's a mixture of taking time out to make sure that you can recharge your batteries, and also having that monkey on your shoulder, which all of us have, which drives so many of us on, which is, you're not quite good enough. You've got that imposter syndrome always going on. And that certainly drives me to always want to do better and to progress and to go for new challenges. So to all of you out there who kind of wake up in the morning feeling sometimes anxious or sometimes worried about what you're going to do next, you know, breathe it in, accept it, go with it, but use it.
It's
Judi Dench always says, she gets nerves and she gets terrified before she goes on stage. And she says, but you know what? I treat it like rocket fuel.
Yeah. You still get that?
I'm nervous. Yeah, of course. Every time. But it's good. Treat it like rocket fuel. Use it to fuel your next move, your next project, your next big thing.
Yeah. I do think everyone has that self-doubt where you know, sometimes you're wearing your suit and you feel like a little kid dressed up in parents' clothes or...
Yeah.
Even the most powerful people in the world, or sometimes especially the most powerful people in the world.
Of course, and sometimes that's why they're the most powerful people in the world.
Yeah. In your career, like looking back, what would you say to little Amanda, to young Amanda, who's just starting off, even just starting off in advertising or just starting off in fundraising sector, what do you wish you'd known?
God.
Or maybe you knew it all, did you?
No, sort of. What do I wish I'd say? Do you know, I'm slightly lost for word.
You, Amanda. I've never seen you lost for words yet.
I think I was... I would have given myself confidence a bit of a boost, I think, when I was younger. I think at times I was absolutely terrified of a lot of the things I did. And I covered it up by a big extrovert front. And I was probably more scared at times than people ever knew or recognized. And I look back on that now and I think there was no need. There was no need. So a bit of reassurance, I think, to my earlier self and to anybody else out there who kind of gets that same feeling sometimes.
We all need that sometimes, don't we? You know, you're okay. You're doing good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Amanda, if you ever get that feeling, you can know that I think you're doing amazing. I think you're great. So it's good. And I'm glad that we had you on here. If anyone wants to know more about you, or you want to point someone in the right direction, where can we keep an eye on what you're doing besides the most influential list? Where else do we find you?
So I'm an intermittent tweeter.
Yeah.
I keep thinking that I should do more of it. I think it's at Amanda Bringens.
Yeah.
And I'm an even more intermittent LinkedIn person.
Yeah.
But you will see occasional stuff out there. I speak on platforms as often as I can find the time to do so. Mm-hmm. And there's always the British Heart Foundation website, which is fabulous as well. So I'll try and do a bit more tweeting if anybody wants to catch up.
Yeah, you should hire someone to do it for you.
Yes, that'd be nice.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right, so we'll find you on Twitter. But yeah, I mean, I keep an eye on the British Heart Foundation because it's always very interesting to see what you guys do with your fundraising.
Yeah.
Because you're usually ahead of the curve. So I'd recommend anyone else listen to this, keep an eye on you through that, and we'll see what happens to you on next year's most influential list. Do you move up? Do you move down?
Or disappear together altogether?
Yeah,
start who knows? Now.
Yeah, it'd be good.
Thank all you, right. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Have you? It was really lovely to catch up. I was blown away when I met you, and it was like, you know, when you have these dinners and you sit people next to people, and they're always nice and they're always fine, but sometimes you have someone you're like, there's that little spark, and you just the night flies by. So it was really a pleasure to meet you, and lovely to meet you. All right.
So now we've both been incredibly nice to each other and bored the listeners to death. We can sign off and...
Tell me three things you hate about me. All right. Okay. Thanks a million, Amanda.
Take care.
See you
later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't. Whatever. You're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hello. This is Morgan Freeman. For discounts on Simon's best-selling online fundraising courses, go to www.changefundraising.com/training. And use coupon code PODCAST. Complete them in your own time, wherever you want. Get busy living or get busy buying.